From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. China has responded. Beijing announced this morning that it's raising tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. imports. Trade talks between China and the U.S. broke down on Friday after President Trump let loose his own volley of new taxes on Chinese goods. The president defended his escalation of the trade war on Twitter today, saying the Chinese will be hurt very badly if they don't make a deal. But yesterday, his own economic advisor said both sides would pay. NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe joins us now. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
So as we said, this is part of ongoing trade talks. Last week, the president accusing China of backing away from agreements, raising tariffs to 25% from zero on some goods to 25% from 10 on some other goods, making American companies, presumably consumers, pay more for importing those Chinese goods into this country. This morning, China retaliates, raising tariffs on goods sold to China from America. The president holding his ground, claiming that this trade war actually boosted the U.S. economy last quarter. What's been the reaction today?
Well, I think right now the president is making this argument that basically that the tariffs are helping, and not only that, and that they're not really affecting U.S. consumers, or at the very least that their impacts are can be avoided by simply making products in the U.S. or places other than China. Of course, the issue with that is that with product chains and things like that, it's not that easy to just move products around. And also when you have these situations where China is maybe dominating the production of a product, then that doesn't mean that U.S. producers then lower their prices just because they went up in China or went up on Chinese products. Sometimes sometimes producers will all raise their prices. So basically what you have is economists are saying that these tariffs are costing U.S. consumers and that they are paying a price. There was a study that even before this latest increase tariffs that found that U.S. consumers were paying more than $1.4 billion a month due to these tariffs. So that is the issue that the White House is kind of grappling with right now.
Well, there seemed to be a rift within the White House over this because his own economic advisor acknowledged as much yesterday. Let's listen to Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, speaking with Fox News Sunday's Chris Wallace and acknowledging that the American consumer does bear some of the burden of this trade war.
Both sides will pay in these things. And, of course, it depends.
If it's a tariff on goods coming into the country, the Chinese aren't paying.
No, but the Chinese will suffer GDP losses and so forth. With respect to a diminishing export market and goods that they may need for their own
I understand that, but
economy.
The president says China pays the tariffs. They may suffer consequences, but it's U.S. businesses and U.S. consumers who pay, correct?
Yes, to some extent. I don't disagree with that. Again, both sides will suffer on this.
Well, and again, today, this morning, the president tweeting out, there's no reason for U.S. consumers to pay the tariff if they buy from, as you said, a non-tariffed country or buy U.S. goods. That's the way to go. But as you've said, that's not that easy. So what do we make of this, what seems like a disagreement between Trump and Kudlow?
Well, and in this administration, it's not really unusual for the president to be saying one thing and his advisors to be saying something else. What Trump seems to be trying to do is make this argument that there isn't a price to be paid for the tariffs. I think it may be because the economy is obviously very important to him. It's very important to his reelection, and he doesn't want to be seen as hurting U.S. consumers. But economists just don't agree with that. And I think what Kudlow was trying to make this argument, he was trying to kind of thread the needle and say that the U.S. economy is strong, and yes, there are impacts, but it can withstand these impacts, and that ultimately what they are trying to do on trade will be worth it, even though there are these kind of negative impacts right now. I think that's the argument that Kudlow is trying to make. That's not exactly the argument that Trump is making. He's trying to say there is no cost, even right now.
Just in the minute that we have, we're going to take this next topic up quite a bit in a little bit. But the president meeting today with the prime minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, a nationalist, far-right leader. He's limited press freedoms, packed courts, made controversial comments about migrants. What is the president's goal here?
Well, I mean, the president, when he looks at these leaders going around the world, President Trump has been known to kind of embrace leaders, even if they are not as democratic. And he is looking at it as building relationships. And he, of course, is operating on this idea of America first, and that we don't want to tell other people how to run their countries. That has led to him embracing people like North Korea's Kim Jong-un. And obviously, he's even had nice things to say about Russian President Vladimir Putin. So this is kind of par for the course in the way that President Trump has went about his foreign policy.
We're going to give it some breathing room in a couple of minutes. Thank you, NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe.
Thank you.
Well, authorities in Sri Lanka expanded a curfew and blocked social media networks today in response to a wave of revenge attacks against Muslims. A terrorist group that pledged allegiance to the Islamic State killed hundreds of worshippers in Sri Lankan churches on Easter Sunday. Now Christians on the island are attacking mosques. Violence against places of worship has prompted increased security at churches, synagogues, and mosques all around the world, including in Pittsburgh, where that shooting at the Tree of Life synagogue last October left 11 people dead. Lucy Perkins of WESA reports.
On a recent Saturday, worshippers gathered at Rodef Shalom Synagogue for morning services. Couples and families sang and prayed together. To an average worshiper, services don't look any different than they did last October, when a gunman entered the Tree of Life Synagogue just a few miles away and killed 11 people. But hidden throughout this synagogue are panic buttons that connect directly to Pittsburgh police. The synagogue used to have 8 or 9 of them. Now there are plans to install more than 50. Barry Weisband is the executive director of Rodef Shalom and says the attack forced the Jewish community to make changes.
We had several meetings with various constituent groups of the congregation. We knew that we had to communicate and hear what their feedback is.
There are now 2 security guards stationed at the synagogue whenever it's open. It's home to a preschool and regularly hosts events. The Tree of Life congregation is temporarily holding services there now. Additional security cameras have been installed, and visitors may be searched.
It's very expensive to do what we're doing on the road that we are going down right now. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Rodef Shalom has also provided safety trainings in which congregants learn how to run, hide, or fight in case of an attack. Brad Orsini is the director of community security for the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. He monitors security concerns that go beyond the walls of synagogues. In his office, he has files full of anti-Semitic flyers and posters.
Here is an actual picture of vandalism. They put bacon over a rack here, and it says, you lying people are a disgrace to our community. You live like pigs, so you should eat it too. Oink, oink.
And that's on like somebody's porch?
This is on somebody's porch.
Orsini also holds security trainings at synagogues.
We teach our community how to stay alive for 3 to 5 minutes if something bad happens prior to law enforcement coming.
For some Orthodox and conservative congregations, doing activities that are considered work, even turning on lights, are frowned upon or forbidden on the Sabbath. So Orsini tells congregants to make sure their phones are turned on before the Sabbath begins at sundown on Friday. And because preserving life is sacred in Judaism, dialing 911 during the Sabbath is okay. Those procedures saved lives at Tree of Life. Alan Hausman is the vice president for the congregation.
Well, the rabbi was able to make the call. Up until that training, he had never carried his cell phone on the Shabbat, and members of the congregation used to turn their phones off. So all those people were able to make rapid calls, and it helped.
The Tree of Life building remains closed. The sanctuary was untouched, but the building will undergo major renovations over the next several years. Hausman says designing a house of worship that's secure and also inviting is a challenge. They're looking at security guards, cameras, a double door system that would keep people in an outer lobby, and giving congregants a fob to unlock doors.
Unfortunately, the days of just leaving the doors unlocked and people coming in and out are over.
That's true everywhere. There have been shootings at places of worship from Charleston, South Carolina to Christchurch, New Zealand. Most recently, another synagogue shooting in San Diego, California. Hausman remembers that new feeling of vulnerability in the weeks after the Tree of Life attack.
I went to a church service of a wedding, and every door was unlocked the whole time. And at a certain point, my wife said to me, "You've got to stop looking at the doors." And I told her at that point, I just could not stop making sure no one came through those doors.
Is the overarching feeling among the congregation that you do want to still be this open place?
We just don't know yet. As you see things like what just happened in California and that, it just opens up all the wounds and starts the fear all over again.
Hausman knows that he and his congregation will never forget what happened at Tree of Life. A few members still haven't felt comfortable enough to return to services. But there's also hope. A few months ago, Tree of Life celebrated its first bar mitzvah since the attack. For Here and Now, I'm Lucy Perkins in Pittsburgh.
Let's take a few moments now to consider the squid. It's an animal that's been on this planet for hundreds of millions of years. Today, it is one of the biggest drivers of the U.S. seafood industry. But the squid is also smart. It's a cephalopod, which is considered the most intelligent invertebrate on Earth. Joining us now is Sarah McAnulty, a squid biologist at the University of Connecticut. She's also the founder of the nonprofit Skype, a scientist. Sarah, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and before we get to some of the amazing smarts of the squid, I want to find out how you got such a deep appreciation for squids. You were introduced as the world's most impassioned squid nerd on a science podcast, and I understand you have a license plate that reads Squids.
I do, yeah. I think I'm probably the biggest cheerleader for squid there currently is. Yeah, so I've been interested in squid since I was a little kid. I watched this National Geographic movie from that I got out of the library, and they showed cuttlefish, actually, which are the relatives of squid, with this crazy passing cloud, it's called. It's basically when these animals will move a black band of color across their bodies to hypnotize prey. And I was about 8 at the time, and I thought that was the wildest thing I'd ever seen. And I pretty much switched that day from being super into dinosaurs to switching over to cephalopods.
And cephalopods is the group that the squid falls into, the group of animals. What are the other species in that group?
Yeah, all of the cephalopods are cuttlefish, squid, octopuses, and the nautilus.
And do they all have the same level of intelligence?
Not quite. So what we call like the coleoid cephalopods, those are the ones that you would be most likely to eat. So those are the cuttlefish, squid, and octopus. The nautilus still has a shell, so it's quite different from the other three, and it's not nearly as advanced. I think what's really, really cool about squid and cuttlefish and octopuses is that they are so advanced, but they're very, very different from us. So, for example, they are able to change color, and they communicate with that color change. So, for example, when reef squid are mating, they are able to signal to their mate that they like them effectively, and at the same time signal to other males that they basically are aggressive and to not come and attack them.
And they can also, I was reading, cut off a piece of their tentacle, let's say, that will then float away in the water so that they can lure their predators away from them.
Yeah, they have a number of really cool ways to evade predation. And another way they do this is they squirt out ink. So you may have seen like a cloud of ink, like a smoke bomb, but they also have what's called a pseudomorph. So that's basically a blob of ink that they make about the same size and shape as them so that a predator will attack the ink blob instead of them.
Do we know if this is learned behavior?
I don't think so. I think this is something that they pretty much come right out of the egg doing. And there's one other really cool thing that I'll tell you about right now is that pygmy squids, these squid are like less than an inch long. They're really tiny. They use their ink in addition to getting away from predators as a way of hiding from their prey. So if you've ever gone hunting, you'll use a blind to hide behind when you're trying to get your prey. And so they will put out a shield of ink and then pounce through the ink to attack their prey. Hmm. So these animals are really, really advanced behaviorally, and they use all sorts of different ways to navigate their environment.
How social are they?
So some cephalopod species are super social, and others really spend most of their lives alone. So there is this one species of squid that lives off the coast of California. It's called the Humboldt squid. And these squid are about the size of a person or a little bit smaller, and they're really fierce predators. Their bite force is stronger than an African lion's. They're really cool animals. And so they will hunt in big packs, and they'll also flash white and red to communicate with each other. So these guys are really social. And then we also have the reef squid that live in Belize and all over the Indo-Pacific, and they will communicate to each other as well using color pattern and color change. And see, so these guys spend a lot of time in groups and eat in packs and spend a lot of time together. They also kind of evade predation by being in groups. And then there are octopuses who really only get together to mate. This is also true of a lot of cuttlefish species. They're pretty much loners. They're hiding most of the time, and they just come together when it's time to mate.
Now, they've all been around for like millions of years, right?
Yeah, so the first cephalopod emerged about 500 million years ago,
wow.
But they looked pretty different from the ones that we see today. So those all had shells, and they were basically the first animals to come up off the seafloor. So everybody was living, crawling around on the bottom of the ocean, and then they put a little bit of air in their shells and sort of lifted up like a hot air balloon on top of the seafloor.
So do you think that some of these impressive qualities are simply because they have had so long to evolve and they're able to develop these amazing features like being able to change color just because they've been around for hundreds of millions of years?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that has a lot to do with it because they've been around so long that not only have they had a long time to develop interesting stuff, they also have really been able to develop things that are different from each other. So you have squid that are living deep in the ocean that are developing like bioluminescent light producing organs. And then you have the shallow water squid that are doing their color changing chromatophore maneuvers. So even within the cephalopods, you have a lot of really unique and cool adaptations that these animals use to get by. And it's also cool, I think, for us to look at these animals because they diverged in evolution so, so long ago from us. But they're basically the most advanced behaviorally animals of their kind of lineage. So if you look at animals very similar to us, you can kind of understand what it's like to be a cat. You know, you
just look down on everybody, you know, all the time.
Yeah, and exactly. But I mean, you can like relax on a couch. You enjoy being touched. They enjoy being touched. But a cuttlefish or a squid, instead of just being head, elbows, knees, and toes, they're like arms, eyeballs, butt, torso, like it doesn't, it's just bizarre from even looking at their like body plan. So these animals, they're so different, even though they're trying to like solve the same problems that any earthling is going to have to solve.
They don't live very long though, right?
They don't. The longest lived cephalopod that we're aware of is this deep sea octopus called Grimpetuthis, and they live about 15 years. You know?
Do you yourself eat squid?
So here's the thing. I was a vegetarian for 10 years, but I think a lot about how we can live sustainably, and eating squid is more sustainable than a lot of other fisheries. We've fished out a lot of the predators of squid, like bigger fish. And so what we have left is squid that are present in huge numbers in the ocean. They get to regenerate very quickly. If you have an animal like a cod, they take many, many years to reach adulthood. And a squid takes like months. And so if you're going to be fishing for an animal that you need to feed a huge population with, squid are really a great choice. So while I love squid and I raise them here in our lab and I really like to hang out with them and maybe I feel a little guilty eating them, just because, you know, if you raise something right. from day one, you feel a little bad. But I don't want to discourage people in general from eating squid because it's really a good, sustainable choice.
What is one thing that you still don't know about squids that you hope you will learn in your lifetime?
Oh, man, that is such a good question. There's so much that we don't know about squid, particularly the cognition of squid is really cool. So squid are able to, and this also goes for cuttlefish and octopus, squid are able to match their background very well. They're able to camouflage really effectively, but they're colorblind as far as we can tell. So how are they so good at picking the colors to be in their background if they can't see color? I think that's super bizarre and super cool. And I'd love to know how the heck they're doing that.
Okay, well, fittingly, we have to end the segment with the squid dance. So I just want to ask you, first of all, what is that that we're listening to?
Okay, so the squid dance is super funny. So in Hakodate, which is part of a place in Japan, squid are like a big part of their culture out there. And so they have a squid festival every year, and they do something called the squid dance. I only know about this because when all of the squid biologists get together at like the International Advisory Council for Cephalopods, we all do the squid dance.
Really?
It's like very silly and fun. Basically, the dance is dancing different types of squid. So like first you put your hands in a triangle above your head, and those are like the kind of squid that we have here, like the kind of pointy arrow looking squid. And then you put your hands above your head in an oval, and those are the reef squid that I've talked about a couple times. And basically it's a celebration of the squid coming in for the squid fishermen, because they're going to be having a huge catch of squid at that time of year. And for a bunch of squid biologists, having a dance and a song about your study organism is about as good as it gets for us in terms of party songs.
So let's all do the squid dance, and people can see it at hereandnow.org. Sarah McAnulty, squid biologist at the University of Connecticut, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's Best Inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Emberwave, balance through temperature.
Global markets fell today after Chinese officials said this morning they're raising tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. imports. President Trump hit Chinese goods with higher tariffs on Friday. And the two countries are now in an all-out trade war. So how will it affect you? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and joins us now. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So are we at the point, and we've been asking this for a while, where consumers are finally really going to feel this trade war?
You know, kind of depends what you're shopping for, I guess. But, you know, tariffs have already hurt U.S. consumers. Nearly $69 billion in extra costs. That's according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. And, you know, look, this increase that we just saw that's going to take place, you know, it's really not immediate. It'll take some time for the goods that shipped after midnight on Friday to get to the U.S. But that increase could tack on, let's say, somewhere between $500 and $1,000 for an average household this year.
You just may not notice it with an individual item.
Yes, that's right, because these tariffs cover thousands of items. And we're talking about everything from furniture to leather handbags and backpacks and baseball gloves. So, you know, I'm not saying that you might not notice something a little bit more expensive here and there, especially for a large item like a piece of furniture. But maybe if your cabbage, your kale, or your beets went up by a few pennies, you might not notice it. So just know that prices are rising for many of these goods. It just really depends how long these tariffs stay in place, because we know they're in place today, but could get rolled back tomorrow.
What about American jobs? Have they increased at all as a result of the tariffs, as the Trump administration has been arguing that they would?
Well, the problem is that when you have an increase on one hand, you might lose some jobs on the other. And I think the most instructive case could be, for example, where you have a domestic manufacturer, say, of a washing machine. We were told that by those producers, they added 1,800 jobs last year because of the tariffs that went into effect on washing machines that came into the United States. So, hey, the domestic guys ramped up their production, hired more people. Unfortunately, the costs attributed to consumers totaled almost $1.5 billion, or $815,000 per job created. Mm-hmm. So the reality is someone's losing in that battle. It's probably the U.S. consumer. Not enough jobs particularly attributable to the tariffs at this point.
Now, when you look at stocks today, it does not look very pretty. And there are some that are down more than others. If you look at Apple, down more than 5% in early trading today. Who's getting hit the worst by the trade war?
Well, you mentioned Apple. Just know that China represents about 18% of revenues for Apple. Look at a company like Intel. 25% of Intel's sales come from China. Or Caterpillar, you know, which is selling a ton of stuff into China, as is Boeing, as is Deere. These are the big names that are going down. Of course, this has nothing to do with tariffs, but I should also note shares of Uber are down 11% today following that first day loss of 7%. So everything's going down, some things much more than others.
And finally, Jill, just quickly, the president's been saying tariffs are adding money to U.S. coffers. Is that true?
Well, tariffs are taxes imposed by the government, and it looks like that there was $41 billion that came in the last fiscal year. Mm-hmm. That is a drop in the bucket of the trillions and trillions of dollars of revenues raised by the federal government. So what we're losing from consumers, we are not making up in the government.
Jill Schlesinger at CBS News, thank you.
Take care.
President Trump is having his first Oval Office meeting today with Hungary's far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Is this another sign of President Trump's affection for strong-arm leaders? Steve Bannon says Orban was Trump before there was a Trump. Or is this the U.S. dangling a carrot to lead Orban down a more democratic path? Orban has whipped up anti-immigration hatred by demonizing migrants. He's rewritten the country's constitution, eliminating checks and balances, stacked the courts, taken over independent media. John Shattuck is a senior fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's also former president of the Central European University. This is the school George Soros founded to champion democracy in Hungary after the collapse of the occupying Soviet Union. Orban has now forced that school out of the country. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, and you're not the only one saying that Trump's meeting today is an embrace of an autocrat. Mr. Trump's own ambassador to Hungary, David Kornstein, said in The Atlantic last week, "I can tell you, knowing President Trump for a good 25 to 30 years, he would love to have the situation Viktor Orban has, but he doesn't," and meaning, of course, the power that he has in his own country. But Orban's been asking for this meeting for a while. The Times has quoted a former Hungarian ambassador to the U.S. saying this is actually an embarrassment to Orban that it took so long.
Well, I think that's true. There's no surprise here that the meeting is taking place because I think Trump and Orban have a lot in common. But it's certainly true that for quite some time now, Mr. Orban has wondered why he wasn't being invited to the White House. I think there are a lot of other people, particularly at other levels of the State Department and elsewhere, who have reservations about bringing him because Orban represents not only an attack on democracy, as you've described, and we can go into that in more detail, but also he's something of a threat to transatlantic security because he spent quite a bit of time engaging further with Russia. He's been frustrating the efforts on the part of NATO to deal more constructively with Ukraine. He's refused to allow suspected Russian arms dealers to be dealt with by the U.S. So the fact is that Orban is definitely a threat both to democracy and to transatlantic security, and there are many outside of the White House who have seen it that way.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you mentioned these arms dealers. When found, Orban had them sent to Russia instead of to the U.S. as the U.S. required to be tried here. And you talk about the concerns about him, maybe some in Washington wanting to keep him at arm's length. A group of senators, including Republicans, wrote the president on Friday and said, Hungary is spiraling out of a democracy. But could this be the U.S. trying to counter influence from Russia and China in Hungary? Could, you know, this be a move on the part of Trump and others in the White House to maybe course correct?
Well, that's a position that a number of people have articulated, but I think it's wishful thinking, because I think that Orban is so far along on his down the road toward being an authoritarian without any real checks and balances or limitations on the power that he's asserting inside his own country. As you say, he's basically sidetracked and taken over the independent media. He's basically undermined the independence of the judiciary. He's attacked civil society. And he's also been very harsh on universities, and the Central European University, which I headed until 2016, is the first university in Europe to be forced out of a European country since the 1930s.
Well, so, and I should say, this is something the Trump administration, as much as they might have people in the Republican Party and in the Trump White House might rail against George Soros, the Democratic philanthropist who founded this school after the fall of the Soviet Union. He's a Hungarian-American. To pursue democratic ideals in a country where he didn't grow up with them, as much as the Trump might be against George Soros, the administration very much wanted that school to stay, and Orban still forced it out.
Yes, that's right. Well, certainly the efforts were made by the State Department to try to mediate and prevent the university from being forced out of the country. But my concern is that President Trump really sees Orban as a soulmate. They have certainly an agenda that's primarily an economic agenda involving oil and gas. But I doubt that the president is going to do more than embrace this authoritarian leader. And the result of that is going to be that Orban will now campaign for the European parliamentary elections, flaunting his meeting endorsement by President Trump and fueling the Eurosceptic voters who are trying to take apart the European Union. So it's a very dangerous moment, I think, at least vis-a-vis U.S.-Hungary relations.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what Orban calls his illiberal democracy, what he's trying to create there. People might remember when there were huge protests in Hungary because there was a new labor law that allowed employers, and you write about this, allow employers to compel overtime to make up for a labor shortage that was created by over a million young Hungarians leaving because of Orban's rule. And then they had, you know, they don't have the immigrant force that they need because of his hard stance on migration. So it resulted in this law compelling overtime. I mean, talk a little bit more about some of the sharper things. I mean, we hear about how he is taking over different aspects of society, but give us some sharper details on that.
Well, essentially what the model is, and he's called it, he given it his own name, illiberal democracy, it's that you use a democratic election to take down the checks and balances of democratic institutions, to tear apart, which is what's happened, the independent media by taking it over through regulation or through government takeover. So there are many aspects of it. The one that you mentioned, particularly the effort to impose overtime requirements in order to make up for the labor loss, is an indication to some extent of the potential weakness of this model that that Orban is pursuing. But it's certainly a result of the pressure that many people have felt to leave the country because they can't compete for jobs with others who are left in the country and who are who may be favorites of the government.
Well, Professor Shattuck, I'm wondering, and I want to say this delicately, is there maybe something now embedded in the Hungarian people that makes them maybe more susceptible to this kind of an autocratic leader? They have been under many thumbs, behind the Iron Curtain when it was lowered by the Soviet Union, then the Berlin Wall fell, communism fell, Hungary joined NATO, the European Union. Orban himself was once a centrist against Russia. Is there some gravitational pull, or what happened here?
Well, I think it's certainly true that Hungarians have been besieged for centuries, and they've had very little experience with democracy, in fact, none. And they are understandably very sensitive to outside pressures in that regard. But I think what Orban has done here is it goes way beyond anything that is relating to the susceptibility of Hungarians to this kind of governance.
Yeah, it's kind of awkward language. We don't mean the, you know, within the soul of the people themselves. But how is, you know, continue, how is he ruling that plugs into something?
Well, he uses all kinds of propaganda and misrepresentation relating to perceived threats from outside, especially in the first, he's really had two targets in the recent elections, one of the migrants, and then most recently he's used George Soros as a target and others with it, broad indications of anti-Semitism, and some of the nature of the attacks are really quite remarkable language that's been used in ways where...
Well, you write that this populist nationalist fear helping Prime Minister Orban, you believe maybe also helping President Trump, is a reaction to the excesses of globalization and the elite promoting it, that there are communities in Europe where people feel left behind, as they do here. And so there's a cautionary tale here, you know, going forward about somehow trying to bridge that divide.
Yes, I think that's a very important point. And so it's really incumbent, I think, upon those who want to stand up for democracy to find ways of building coalitions across political divides and really attacking issues like growing inequality, which is a major issue in the United States and in Europe, certainly in Hungary, as well as finding ways of providing economic fairness for more and more people. So, you know, there's a real agenda here to respond to the Orbans and the Donald Trumps of the world.
That's John Shattuck, senior fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, also former president of the Central European University, which was in Hungary and has been forced out. It's on its way to Vienna. Professor Shattuck, thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you watched last night's episode of HBO's Game of Thrones, you'll recognize that sound. The show is coming to an end this coming Sunday. So those of you who don't watch, it's almost over. And those who do, let's talk about it with Dan Coyce, a writer and editor at Slate. Dan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much.
And first of all, do you think we should do spoilers or not at this point? It's been, you know, many hours since the episode aired.
I am a strong believer that at this point, if Game of Thrones is so important to you that you're going to be annoyed if you hear about it on the radio, you should have watched it already.
Right. Or just turn the radio off for a few minutes.
Or just turn the radio
off. So therefore, I'm going to give the spoiler alert that there may be spoilers in this conversation. Dan, what did you think of last night's episode, first of all?
Last night's episode was one of the first ones this season that really felt to me like it did the things that Game of Thrones does well. Like, it surprised me and shocked me and was gruesome and awful at times, but also had a bunch of, like, great moments.
Well, and a lot of things happened that we've been all waiting for. Not necessarily those particular things to happen, but we've been waiting to see whether things would happen that would be really consequential, and many did last night.
Right. We've been waiting for resolution on about 20 different storylines, and about 15 of them got resolved last night.
Okay, but it's interesting that you say that you thought that they did it well, because let me just read you a few tweets that are out there today, and I'm sure you've seen this kind of sentiment about last night. Quote, I never thought I would put Game of Thrones in the same category as Lost and Dexter in terms of terrible last seasons, but I think it's too late now. This is awful, lazy writing, and whoever directed that should never direct anything again. Somebody else says, I guess these dudes are good at adaptations, but horrible at actual writing. Way to ruin a great series. Another person says, this might be the first time I've actually felt disappointed in a Game of Thrones episode. Why do you think people are so angry?
I think that people have built up various impossible versions of what this season could do in their heads that have to do less with the lessons and ideas that the show was always interested in exploring and more to do with the characters that they've come to associate themselves with or love or find aligned with their particular narrative agendas. You know, the show has always been, we can now see, building toward this idea that power corrupts and that it is very hard to shake off your origins or the monster that you have been turned into. And that's what we saw happen to character after character in this episode last night. You know, we saw Dani turn into the person that her birth and origins always suggested she might become. And to me, those are like satisfying resolutions to a story that began with characters like Ned Stark and like Joffrey and like Cersei unable to shake off the monsters that their upbringings and their origins had turned them into.
Do you think that part of the disappointment also is that people were hoping to see a strong woman emerge as the leader that everybody loves, and now that looks very unlikely?
It seems extremely unlikely, although there's still a strong woman waiting up in the north who
That's
you never know
true.
What could happen with her.
you never forget about Winterfell.
That's right. But yes, I do think that it was very interesting to me to see the sort of political hopes and expectations that people had for Daenerys, which I think have had a lot to do with the way that the electoral fortunes of women have gone in the last couple of mm-hmm. years in the United States, be undercut by a story that's, you know, that has been drawn up for 20 years by George R. R. Martin. What we're seeing right now is the end of the story as George Martin wanted it to be and as the creators of the show assured him they would do.
Okay, let's just talk quickly about the business of this for HBO. What's going to happen after this Sunday for that network? What's going to be the next big thing? Because I think they wanted Westworld to be that, but I'm not quite sure that it's going to be.
I have extremely high hopes for the miniseries that they are doing of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. Now, that is not something that can run 8 seasons like Game of Thrones, but that, too, is a big, all-encompassing fantasy world with richly satisfying characters and unlike perhaps for many Game of Thrones, an ending that is, you know, emotionally rich and in many ways uplifting. It seems sort of unlikely that Game of Thrones is going to have an uplifting ending at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's been interesting watching the way HBO has tried to present itself. You know, for many of us who don't watch that much HBO, the HBO we get is like what we see in the bumpers before and after Game of Thrones. And so watching them present this cornucopia of material that they're hoping someone is going to latch onto has been really interesting. At the same time, HBO, from a business standpoint, all of a sudden is trying to transform itself into a company that deals in volume, that isn't just great Sunday night programming, maybe great one other night programming. They want to have great shows every night of every week. And in a world where there's 2,000 TV networks, it seems like that seems trickier.
Okay, Dan Coyce, before we let you go, who do you think will end up on the Iron Throne?
I'm going for a Sansa-Tyrion doubleheader. I hope those two guys get it together and rule with a steady hand. I also think it's entirely possible that this show ends in complete chaos.
Dan Coyce, who is a writer and editor at Slate, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
It's already in complete chaos right now, so I mean, maybe it can get even more chaotic. We'll see on Sunday. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and as I always say, never forget about Winterfell. I have no idea what I'm talking about. It's here and now.